Hey, Natalie.
Hey, Kenny. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I feel like I just learned so much about tobacco use and how I should be thinking about it and how I haven't been thinking about it the right way for a while.
I learned that too. And also, we have a new person with us. Hi, Kat.
Hey, Kat. We're so happy you're joining us tonight.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. I haven't actually been on this podcast, but I'm a longstanding fan.
Well, and you've also been working behind the scenes, putting these episodes together. So we're happy to have you behind the mic tonight. Do you want to just tell our listeners quickly who you are?
Sure. So I am an internist and addiction medicine doctor. I finished my fellowship recently at Montefiore, and I'm starting at NYU at their Brooklyn campus. So I'll be managing their addiction medicine program.
Great. Well, welcome back, everyone, to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. As you just heard, I am here tonight stepping in for our fearless leader, Dr. Carolyn Chan, and I'm here with two fabulous co-hosts, Dr. Natalie Stahl and Dr. Kat Mullins. And on tonight's episode, we'll be discussing tobacco use disorder with Dr. Panagis Galiatsatos. Before we get started with that, Natalie, do you want to remind the audience what we do on the show?
Sure. So we are the internal medicine podcast for all things addiction medicine. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of medical educators. And a reminder that most episodes are available for free CME credit. That's through VCU Health CE for all health professionals. That's at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account.
And a special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM. They've partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty and trainees. They're committed to supporting and training the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. Learn more about the organization at their website, acam.org. And whether you're an addiction medicine physician preparing for the ABPM board exam, or you're a physician in practice, who's just looking to learn more about addiction medicine, ACAM offers several study products that can help meet your needs. So they have the professional practice bundle that includes access to 86 self-assessment modules. It provides CME. There's also 46 didactic lecture recordings that comes with that package. I mean, there's also a board prep bundle that also offers access to the 46 didactic lectures, along with nearly a 200 item question bank and its addiction e-practice test. So to learn more about these and other product offerings, as well as membership opportunities, visit acam.org.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
So we have a fantastic conversation with our guest tonight, Dr. Panagis Galiatsatos. So Dr. Galiatsatos is an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and a physician in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine. He is the co-chair of the Johns Hopkins Health Equity Steering Committee and is the co-director and co-founder of Medicine for the Greater Good. During the pandemic, he assisted in vaccine equity throughout the city of Baltimore, cared for patients in the COVID-19 intensive care units, and assisted in establishing post-COVID-19 care. His community outreach resulted in international curriculum for youth on COVID-19, as well as hundreds of town halls. These meetings focused on teaching global communities about the pandemic and how these communities could play a role in ending the crisis. His additional clinical responsibilities center on critical care services in adult populations. He works as director of the Tobacco Treatment Clinic at Johns Hopkins Medicine, associate director of the Hereditary Hemorrhagic Telangiectasia Center of Clinical Excellence, and is a physician in the Obstructive Lung Disease Group at Johns Hopkins Medicine and in the post-COVID-19 acute clinic. He's authored books and over 80 research articles on community engagement and its impact on health and health equity. In addition to his teaching responsibilities, he oversees Hopkins' Interdisciplinary Tobacco Treatment Clinic. Today, he teaches us some great pearls about integrating mindfulness into the patient interview, eliminating the idea of pack years from our practice, and he'll explain why, and also how to manage patient expectations around short-acting and long-acting nicotine replacement therapy.
Yes. So thanks, Kat. It sounds like this is going to be a smoking hot episode. So let's get tobacco into it. Sorry, that was terrible. Sean's not here tonight. Sorry, everyone.
Oh, a brief plug. Friends of the Podcast will be launching a new series entitled Behind the Evidence, the Addiction Medicine Podcast. It's hosted by Enora Englander and Mark LaRochelle, and it's supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center's Alcohol, Other Drugs, and Health Current Evidence newsletter. And you can learn more. We'll post some information in our show notes.
All right. Hi, Panagis. Thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. Let's start with some rapid fire questions to get to know you a little bit better. So can you give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
A one-liner to describe myself? Sure. I am a Greek American born and raised in Baltimore to Greek immigrant parents who really just enjoys travel and being a dad.
Great. Well, speaking of travel, or maybe not travel, but can you tell us one of the most adventurous things you've done?
One of the most adventurous things I've done. Probably it's occurring as we speak. It is coaching my 8-year-old daughter's soccer team. So trying to keep up with pop culture references at the moment is really, it's like harder than studying for USMLE step one.
That sounds very challenging.
That sounds very adventurous.
How are they doing? Are they winning any games?
Our first game is this weekend, so we're very much excited. We came up with our own team name. We are the Carolina Blue Unicorns. So, you know, we couldn't decide on one name, so we just combined a lot of names. But yeah, no. And the other thing I'll add to this is I am an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins in pulmonary and critical care medicine. So that is my title when I step foot into the hospital.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again for being with us tonight. Natalie, do you want to get us started with our first case?
Sure. So we'll get started with a case of Mr. T. He is a 60-year-old gentleman. He has a 30-pack year smoking history, and he comes to clinic for follow-up after a hospitalization for a COPD exacerbation. He tells you, my wife says I can't smoke in the house anymore, and honestly, this hospital stay has me worried too. I want to quit, but that patch in the hospital didn't help me. I couldn't wait home to get home and have a cigarette. So we were just going to start off with trying to understand, when you're talking to a patient, how do you approach assessing someone's tobacco use? What information do you gather? How do you determine the level of nicotine dependence they have? Where do you start the conversation?
Love this. So I'm going to start off by first kind of attacking medical culture and try to stop two things. One is packs per year. Like, it's great to say it if I want to assess their epidemiological risk factor for lung cancer, but it doesn't tell me anything about the person who smokes, right? 2 years of five packs a day versus 5 years of two packs a day gets me to the same number. So that is not, in a sense, telling me of someone's smoking dependence, just because of such variability. But that really came to light, really, to tell me, should I screen them for lung cancer? And two, I actually said this earlier to medical students. I never want you to say the words to a patient, I want you to quit smoking. We don't say that for any other disease. I don't tell patients, quit having diabetes, quit having hypertension, and manage it with them, right? If they're going to come in and identify as a smoker, my goal with them is becoming a non-smoker. And I see that because actually that's how I start off every conversation. I make them rethink this journey. I don't bring up this notion of smoking and quitting it. I bring up, if you've been doing this activity for the majority of your life, the goal for the next chapter is unsmoking. It is learning how to become a non-smoker. And that tends to ease people. It tends to ease the patient to understand, I don't need to take on this fad. Like, if someone said the words to you, like, start dieting, you're going to get anxious. I know I do. It's like, oh my gosh, I got to change my whole life. No, like, do it without stigma, without judgment, calmly, carefully, right? In my world, the other thing I tend to tell patients, I'm pro-smoker, just anti-smoking. And to get that to that level of becoming a non-smoker takes time. Took you time to become a smoker, takes time to become a non-smoker with every action of unsmoking. So I set the stage right off the bat with every patient. I try to make it comfortable with them. I try to make sure that they understand this is a place of no judgment. Because, you know, I know you asked me guys a great question, but I got to really set the stage, because patients that come tend to be frustrated with the medical community, because all they've heard in their life is quit, you're doing this to yourself, How could you still be doing this? Right? They're tobacco dependent and no one is telling them how to manage it. They just keep emphasizing, quit, quit, quit. It drives them crazy, appropriately so. We've really failed people who smoke. And so I tried to, in the first 5 to 10 minutes, establish a notion of homophily, which is a tactic I use for motivational interviewing. So they see me as one of themselves. I've never smoked, but I have a level of empathy by understanding the science of what they're going through. Because every patient who leaves my clinic is like, you must be a smoker. You know too much. Like, nah, just, I care about you guys. And I learn as much as I can. So my first, whether we call it a tactic or not, is really just being a human being with them. Another kind of surrogate variable to discuss how much people who smoke get stigmatized in the medical culture, a third of my patients who come in on their medical records, they're listed as never smoker. So I'm sitting there like, says you're never smoker. Like, I'm not going to admit I smoke. Like, people start judging me for it. I'm like, yeah, I get it. So the first things I do is undo how they view this. I undo it all. I remove that and set the stage of taking on this new identity as a non-smoker. Once I have that, a lot of the information I take on after that really just, just explodes out of the person. Because once we do that, we begin to set the stage. So now I'll walk you through a little bit more succinctly of the data that I do gather. First, I tend to ask them age that they started. This, to me, why I choose this variable, a lot of it has to do with how permanently entrenched are they in their smoking habits. The biochemical background of this is, working in the mesolimbic cortical area, right? Your reward center, your survival center, depending if you're talking to a neurologist or addiction medicine individuals or psychologists, right? This is where a ton of those kind of Pavlovian dog responses start building up, right? Conditional responses, right? You get hungry if you walk into the kitchen. You don't get hungry if you walk into the bathroom, right? You're conditioned for certain reactions that your brain is recognized for survival. The younger you are when you start those conditional responses, the more likely they're going to be ingrained permanent, right? A lot of it has to do with the delta phosphate protein that's released and maintains that connection of permanence. So I asked them, how old were you when you started? Now, with that said, if they started later on in life, doesn't mean those aren't well orchestrated, well connected. They may still be depending on their severity of tobacco intake. But the key thing of that to me is how much I need to invest also in relapse prevention. Because I can get every patient to quit, but relapse prevention is part of the strategy to make them into a non-smoker. So I got to make sure I know what I'm doing once I get them off of cigarettes and how much emphasis I need to put on that. Next variables I take in is quality and quantity of their smoking behaviors. How many and how much of it? Because if they tell me, in addition to that, I ask them the brand. You got to know the brand, right? Because high-end brands, expensive brands, your Marlboros, your Newports, they tend to have something called a burn rate that's much greater versus cheaper-end brands, meaning they don't self-extinguish as fast, right? They have to. There's a cap in it by a law made in the 1990s, so cigarettes can self-extinguish so they don't burn the house down if you fall asleep smoking. But really expensive brands take a while to self-extinguish. Versus your cheap end brands, they go out after one or two puff and a good social conversation. This is why when patients come in, we're going back to those packs per year, I told my residents, well, did you ask them if they smoke USA Slims or Marlboro Reds? They're like, I didn't know. Why does that matter? USA Slim, two puffs, 3 minute conversation, it's gone. You're going to the next cigarette. A Marlboro Red, you can be smoking it for a good 30 minute podcast and you're still in that same cigarette, right? But it's still a lot of intake. And if you're using the cigarette as your sole surrogate to what's going on, it's going to be an inappropriate approximation. So I go over brand, how do they smoke it, and how many cigarettes a day. And what I really make them emphasize here is tell me your good days and bad days. Tell me what a Monday smoking looks like and a Tuesday smoking. How much of the cigarette do you smoke when you're anxious? How much of it do you smoke when you're bored? I want to know these factors because it doesn't get me to some severity level, but to them, it begins this frame of mind for probably the first time in their life called mindfulness. My strategy ultimately to get them becoming non-smokers, one of the tactics is mindfulness. Smoking is such a subconscious thing. It's like eating, right? I imagine, Natalie, you're not sitting there with everybody being like, I wonder how my chewing's coming along. When am I gonna swallow that now? No. So if smoking takes advantage of the same parts of the brain and is a subconscious action, the more I can make them conscious of this effort, the more this mindfulness conversation starts happening with them, right? It takes time to ingrain it. But I tell them every time you pick up a cigarette, you got to have that conversation with yourself. Of why do you want the cigarette? And what can you do to say no to it? Because you're obviously saying yes to it. You got to understand how to say no to it. So we're off the bat. I'll stop here because I feel like I'm throwing a lot at you guys. I tried to undo all the implicit bias medicine has given to every patient who smokes. It's really undoing that. That's why my first 5 to 10 minutes is establishing something called homophily with them. After that, three things I take in is the brand, how they smoke, and how much do they smoke. And then prior to that, I also ask them the age they started, because I really want to set the tone of my trajectory, getting them off cigarettes, preventing relapse, because that's how I'm thinking of their medical management right off the bat. On a side note, and I'll stop here. Sorry about this for the rambling. It's like hypertension. You guys know all your efforts don't just stop once the blood pressure is achieved and you're like, all right, let's stop everything. Go about your life. No, you got to think about how to get to those numbers and what do I do once we're there? What medicines do I tweak, et cetera? That's what we do. It's medical management. So let me stop there and throw at me some more insight of the information I threw at you guys, because I'd ask a lot more. I have a 60-minute intake with these patients. We go through a lot.
I admit I've never asked a patient what brand they smoke ever. So that's a good thing to know, because it makes sense that the brand matters, but it has never occurred to me to ask.
So I've never looked into cigarette brands in the New England area, but in Baltimore, I can tell you if they come in, they're like, I smoke Mavericks. I'm like, oh, you probably smoke Marlboros. And they're like, yeah, how'd you know? I was like, Mavericks are the inexpensive Marlboro, right? Because of cigarette taxing, patients tend to kind of go to cheaper end brands. Or if they're like, oh, I smoke USAs. I'm like, you probably used to smoke Newports. They're like, yeah, that's how'd you know? So I can always kind of gauge where they're at, but you can't be fooled by it in regards to nicotine content and tar content. It's more the burn rate that matters, because patients that smoke cheaper end brands probably still pay the same amount as if they stuck with their expensive brand, because they're spending so much because of the high burn rate.
I also love the idea of going into the conversation thinking about mindfulness from the start, just as its own intervention there.
You got to. So if we understand smoking's conditional responses, the pattern of it, parallel something we all do every day is eating. And we plan eating. We know when we're going to eat, right? Timing, what emotions we're going to have, what room. When my med students walked into the new conference room, they immediately probably got hungry. This is a place where I eat. It's Pavlov's dog 101. So you got to get them in that frame of mind, because if they can understand when they smoke and they can predict that, especially the easy times and the hardest times, then you give them the advantage of having that power to be prepared to say no. That's it. For the person to become a non-smoker, they have to be honest with themselves of understanding why they smoke, and then come up with strategies to replace that cigarette. And keep in mind, sometimes the cigarette's a surrogate to more complex things, like anxiety disorders that are undiagnosed. So we got to really help them treat that, right? So that's what I love about this. If once they're in that frame of mind, it takes time for them to really pull that out. But they've realized they've conditioned themselves for their cigarette to kind of be like that blanket from the Charlie Brown cartoons, right? The kid carrying like a safety blanket. That's what I'm getting at. Sorry. But yeah, sorry. Yeah. That's my initial approach. My initial strategy going in there is trying to give them the power back.
So we can keep moving on with the case if that works.
Yes. Go for it. Yes.
So Mr. T, to answer some of the questions you noted, he's been smoking since he was 17. And it's varied how much he smokes throughout his life, but most recently he's been smoking about a pack and a half a day. He has tried to stop or cut down in the past. His granddaughter has asthma and she can't come to the apartment. But even though he's tried many times, both cold turkey and with 21 milligram NRT patches, never made it past a few days. So when you're a patient like Mr. T comes in and wants to start this journey towards being a non-smoker, what are the FDA-approved treatment options? How do they work? How do you discuss what to start?
So I love this. Mr. T sounds like every patient I've ever had, and I love that about them. Going into our journey of becoming a non-smoker, obviously the first action is still quitting. And what's fascinating about that term, and actually, if you guys want to throw out an answer, you're welcome to. I did this earlier today, so a lot of this is now fueled with most recent teaching. I had an attending seasoned physician to med students. I was like, what's the medical definition for quit? And what's great about when I asked that question is everyone gave me different answers. No one's wrong, right? There's no wrong answer, right? Because we've never standardized it. And the reason why I say this is because we clearly, of all the medical conversations we have, here's the most the number one cause of preventable death is a cigarette. And we really don't give it the sophisticated science it deserves. We can't even create a standardized terminology of what quitting means. What is it, a day, 24 hours? Some of my patients look, I've quit thousands of times. So I say all this because what's going to happen with every person who smokes, they're going to come in with one key symptom, right? What chest pain is to a myocardial infarction, ambivalence is to a person who's tobacco dependent. And ambivalence is going to come across as, yeah, I want to stop, but I don't want to stop. So I'm going to start sabotaging your plan before you even tell me. Like, I do want to stop smoking, Dr. G. It's what they affectionately call me. But I've tried the patch. It doesn't work. I've tried cold turkey. I'm hopeless. It's not. They're giving you the sabotage strategy. They're already sabotaging your plan before you even get it out. That's why one of the tactics I use when we're in clinic together is I make them really kind of word vomit out everything they've ever done in the past. Like one of the other intakes I tell, I ask them, is like, how have you tried to stop in the past? I want to know everything so when I go into my plan, I can reframe everything. Oh, you've tried the patches before. Let me tell you how they're supposed to work. Oh, you've tried cold turkey. That's fine. Avoidance is what I call it. Let me tell you how it should work. So I want them to tell me what didn't work in the past because 90% of the time, this is my expert opinion, and I'm just ballparking over that estimate, they just weren't told how this is supposed to work. And once they get that understanding, back to that mindfulness and become a non-smoker, it's like, I can do this now. So how do I approach him? He's sitting here telling me, I've tried this, tried that. This is what I do with patients. The first things first, they have to realize I've yet to identify an FDA-approved medication that will actively slap the cigarette out of their hands. Why that's important for me to say is because I get many of them like, I want to do it on my own. It's like, all right, I don't care. Whatever makes sense for you. But keep in mind, meds or not, you still have to be the one who says no. Now, do you want to say no comfortably without pulling your hair and driving yourself crazy? Sure, doc. Great. Let's talk about medications then. Because their job is not to slap the cigarettes, and it's also not to replace the cigarette, right? I've never met a patient who slapped on a patch and was like, yeah, whew, feeling like I'm smoking now. No, that's not the intention of the patch. No different than eating a grape is going to get you drunk thinking it's wine. No, the grape's got to get fermented, macerated, and so forth, you know, to make yourself a nice Cabernet Sauvignon. Nicotine has to be chemically enhanced, high concentrations, in order to really drive that addiction. Your nicotine replacement therapies are meant to curb cravings. Varenicline's meant to kind of give you the impression you smoked and block the nicotine from having its actions. Bupropion's the same thing. It's meant to give you the impression you smoked. So these medications that are FDA approved, I make it clear I'm giving you these in addition to mindfulness. Mindfulness is the key. Every patient that leaves, we come up with a strategy of how they plan to report back to me when they smoke. I know I just said it, I spend 60 minutes with them, but they leave with it. Look, I'm a lung doctor. Many times we make patients leave with like peak flow diaries for asthma trigger identification. Do the same thing here. I'm like, if you like journaling, you're going to love this. If you don't like journaling, then my nurses will call you. What we need is a good succinct intake of what your Monday smoking looks like, your Tuesday smoking looks like, your Wednesday smoking looks like, a good day versus a bad day. Because I want you to see physically when you smoke. Because every patient that returns back in about 4 weeks and sees that track, they look at me and like, I can cut that cigarette out. I can do that one. I cannot. Suddenly they're realizing how to become non-smokers. I love that. That's an action of unsmoking. So the mindfulness goes in there. And keep in mind, some of them are low-hanging fruit. They can remove the cigarette with a coffee. They have a game plan for that, right? They can come up with tactics. But there's going to be some that are going to be much harder that warrants more medical management for disease that they're compensating for. Maybe it's melancholy, depression that's never been diagnosed and they need real treatment for it. They've just been getting away with the anti-melancholic effects of a cigarette or anxiety that they're getting away with their cigarettes. So sometimes we'll unearth bigger things. Medication choosing, I need to know what the patient also wants out of smoking cessation. Is there a timeline or is there not? Why I'm saying this? Because if they're like, I need new lungs in 3 months, got a lung transplant cooking, maybe not so much for our patient right here. I may actually double up medications because it gets them there faster. But the medication that I select, honestly, where I'm at now in 2022, all of these patients are my refractory ones. So I begin to help them decide which one is the best one for them. That's what I do. What have they tried in the past? And they got to report to me why it worked and didn't work. Sometimes it didn't work. I'll put in the patch of someone that smoked a cigarette. I'm like, you put it on for a day. Yeah, you got to give it time. You got to give it 2 weeks to really kick in, right? There's a timing effect here. Or if they tried varenicline and had suicidal ideation, I'm like, all right, maybe we'll park that. We may not come to it immediately. So I want to hear, because it's hard to find a person who smokes who has not tried things already. So I want to hear what they've tried. So I'll finish with this. I apologize for rambling. You guys can cut me off. I'm Greek intrinsically. I'm going to ramble. But I love this. I can do this all night. So what I would say to any patient first, mindfulness is the key strategy. The medications are meant to make it easier to say no to a cigarette. When choosing which med, I want to hear what they've tried in the beginning. Because remember, I make it clear. Tell me how you've tried in the past. So now I can be prepared. And if they're like, oh, I put on a patch and went to a cigarette, I'm like, that's not the patch's intention. So I can rephrase their sabotage planning. But I will say this. I take the medications and I dichotomize them. I'm a lung doctor, so hopefully you see where this is going. Long-acting inhalers, short-acting inhalers. So we got three long-acting agents, varenicline, bupropion, and nicotine replacement therapy, transdermal. We'll discuss choosing one of those three. You know, if they're dialysis patients, maybe I don't go with Chantix immediately. If they have seizure disorders, maybe I don't go to bupropion. Maybe I'll stick with the NRT. And then they all leave with short-acting nicotine replacement therapies, gum, lozenges. We have inhalers. There's nasal sprays. People love the nasal sprays. And I tell them to use it when they really are struggling. Like I had a patient, this guy's awesome, plays poker Friday nights, and if he's got a bad hand, he's going to want a cigarette. And that's where he discreetly pulls out his nicotine nasal spray, uses it, curbs his cravings, and goes back to the game. So they're meant to use those at really difficult times where their cravings are breaking through the medications. So mindfulness plus medications, long-acting and short-acting. And honestly, the decision I make on which medication, long-acting, is based on their prior history and their current comorbidities and what makes the most sense of starting first. If they need to quit fast, you know, from their standpoint, I got to get a lung transplant, for instance, often comes up, then I'll probably double up the long-acting agents, like varenicline and a patch are really effective versus varenicline alone, or varenicline bupropion for some patients. So I will double up the long-acting agents if their timeline is one that someone else is dictating in a fast pace. So that's how I end up deciding on medications. Honestly, if you were hoping for like some cool notion of like nicotine dependence, in 2022, if you're a person who still actively smokes, knowing how much chemical changes the cigarette companies are doing to nicotine, because I can tell you about nicotine content, but we got to be smart, right? And they're not that we're not, but we got to remember that tobacco companies are like three chess moves ahead of us. So when we've capped nicotine, they were ready for that. They have non-nicotine alkaloids that cause the same level of addictions and aren't regulated. So your nicotine caps are just supplemented with anabasine, cotinine, other things that resemble nicotine, still drive home a good addiction. So it's hard for me to base off like the nicotine levels and say, that's only 8 milligrams in that cigarette. I'll let that out the window. The tobacco companies and their scientists are, I have to give them credit, right? Because these are my enemies. So I got to know my enemy. They're way too smart to really think nicotine's the sole chemical now that's going to drive the addiction. It's the primary one. But they've found a lot of other reasonable supplements to add to reinforce what nicotine's ground is losing.
Oh, okay. So let's get back to the case. So Mr. T decides to try varenicline and nicotine replacement therapy. But he's worried about patches because he still had cravings on them in the past. He has not tried varenicline. So how do you start to talk to him about some of these medications?
No, this is a great question. So first things first, right? One of the things I'm hoping you guys pick up is asking them ahead of time if they've tried this. I say this because the worst thing you can do is like sit back, take this inventory of the, you know, when they smoke, how they smoke, et cetera. This is called your smoking topography. And they're like, all right, I'm going to come up with this plan. And they're like, oh, you know what, doc, I tried the varenicline. Didn't work. And I say this because if it comes up later like that, it really begins to sabotage your plan. Like all the great trust and connectivity you've had with the patient goes away. that ambivalence of doesn't want to quit smoking suddenly takes over. So for Mr. T, I'm asking, what have you tried in the past? And if he's never tried, sounds like he has not tried anything other than the patches. So this is great. So the varenicline, it is a kind of an increase of dose starting at 0.5 milligrams twice a day, and then it increases to 1 milligram twice a day. That's its cap. Before starting varenicline, though, I'm going to do kind of a medication inventory to make sure, A, is this going to interact with any other medications? From that standpoint, I'm also cognizant of other comorbidities, right? This is where you want to dive into. If he has a lot of underlying mental health conditions, you can still use varenicline safely. The Eagle trial published in the Lancet in the 2010s emphasized that. They took patients with schizophrenia, et cetera, and they found it safe. And in the American Thoracic Society guidelines published in 2020, the pandemic emphasizes that as well. It's like one of there's about eight questions that were asked kind of in a meta-analysis manner. Can you start varenicline on patients with mental health disorders? And the answer was a resounding yes. It is safe. You just need closer monitoring. So what I'm looking in is comorbidities, medication interactions, and then finally renal function. This is key because there really isn't too much adjustments until you get to the dialysis. If they get to dialysis, then you're going to really talk to them. You're only taking this medication after HD. So I'm looking at all of that. And then I will, of course, go into the side effects. You have to, because patients will find any little reason to be like, you know what? It's doing this to me. I don't want to do it anymore. I'd rather just go back to the cigarette to some extent. So I try to prepare them. Two things that tend to come up often with these medications, and the tolerance is up to the patient. One is their sleep hygiene. So they'll get to sleep, but they may have really bad dreams, rather vivid dreams. For some patients, they'll tell me that and they're like, I like it. It's fun. Others are like, this is keeping me up at night. I can't do this anymore. And actually, what I would recommend here is really talking to a good sleep doctor to see if they're willing to do a sleep test, because sometimes they can pick up what's happening on the sleep architecture and really discuss like, oh my gosh, if you, for instance, use melatonin strategically. Now, with this said, I'm saying this as an expert opinion. I've done this with patients for kind of research purposes to try to figure out what is happening with the varenicline at night. And so just prepare them for that. Two is nausea. This comes up a lot. So yes, you can mitigate it with eating beforehand, drinking water, staying hydrated. But I will tell you what I have seen with varenicline use and nausea is it tends to really come on when they're smoking on varenicline. So if you think about it, varenicline is a competitive antagonist to those acetylcholine receptors that nicotine's trying to get back to in the ventral tegmental area of the brain. And if they're already being blocked, well, nicotine's going to other places, to other acetylcholine receptors found throughout the body. A lot of them are going to cause symptoms like nausea. Because I've had this conversation with patients. I'm like, what happens when you're not smoking on it? They're like, yeah, the nausea's okay. So I'm seeing to some extent that play out. But I really try to prepare them for those two side effects. Now, does that mean I'm going to stop varenicline altogether? No. Oftentimes, I tell patients, we got the right ingredient. We may just have to think outside the box on the recipe. Right? Because I've had patients just take 0.5 milligrams of varenicline, and that's all they needed. Right. Everyone, I imagine, is a little bit different of how they smoke. So sometimes we find the right medication, good ingredient, we just tweak the recipe. For nicotine replacement therapies, we'll stick with a patch first. You're right. For a lot of patients, best thing I do to prepare them is that it is unlikely to curb your cravings immediately. You're likely going to be on it 2 weeks before you even see it impacting you, and a continuous 2 weeks, right? You're like, on the day, you can take it off at night if it's going to give you some bad, it too can give you bad dreams and so forth. But I got to prepare patients. Like, it's going to take 2 weeks before you really feel like kicking in. With that said, to kind of get ahead of the game for potential myths, you can smoke on a nicotine patch, 100%. Yes, it's safe. It's 21 milligrams that gets highly metabolized by the liver. It's not a lot. There's a great slide by the British Royal Medical Society in 2001 that shows the levels of nicotine from a cigarette in the patch. Patch is low. The patch isn't trying to replace a cigarette. It's just trying to curb, trying to attenuate the gravity of the cravings for a cigarette. That's it. It's not trying to reinforce an addiction. So with that said, I tell patients, I try to prepare them for this. It tends to really take away any concern they have of stopping the meds. Because if they feel a little bit of the nausea or they feel a little bit of the bad dreams, they're like, oh, Dr. G prepared me for this. I'll go back and talk to him and see if we can adjust it. Because the main thing I want to do, I mean, we have three FDA products. if they see a side effect, they're like, I'm done with it. It's a binary, yes or no. They're going to lose hope because many of them realize they need these medications. They're in it. They just need something to make it more comfortable. And that's what I try to prepare them for. NRTs, I really have a contraindication against. The patch is the biggest contraindication I tend to have with a patch is nicotine. I mean, we all take a nicotine. If you had an eggplant today, you took a nicotine, right? It's found naturally in a lot of vegetables as well. It's not the chemical. It's more the taping, the adhesive. So depending if they have a bad reaction to that, I got to understand what the reaction is. If that person put it on and had a systemic hives, we'll stop that and try to find a different patch. There's different ones. The adhesive is what makes a difference. If they have an irritation at the site, some Benadryl cream prior to putting it on can usually take that away as well. So I try to hear what their side effects are from it. I also tend to tell them, don't put it on wounds. It will impair wound healing. But the biggest thing of your patients when you select the medication that makes the most sense for them is to prepare them for the side effects as well. Because I promise you, with their ambivalence, they're looking for any reason to sabotage this. But if things are going in accordance, I mean, what have I asked my patients so far to do, right? Jot down when they smoke and monitor for side effects. The first 4 weeks of me seeing a patient, I don't even ask them to begin cutting down. I want them to get comfortable with these tools. Because if they're comfortable with these tools, they're getting there. They're getting there. They're getting there. Even like the one thing I'm seeing too, what's probably a little unorthodox compared to what we were trained with the 5A's. And in the new, again, American Thoracic Society guidelines, I don't ask for a quit date. I will start the medications, like I'm saying now, so they can get comfortable, let it kick in, let it curb the cravings. And suddenly they're like, yeah, I'm ready for it, doc. I'm ready for it. It's perfect. And I see this to model almost every other disease. Oh, go ahead, Kat.
Going off of that, I'm curious how you actually think about dosing for the nicotine starting out, because I'm pretty sure for the first 2 years of residency, I was just chronically underdosing everyone's nicotine patches. So how do you talk to patients about that? How do you adjust the dose if it's working or not working?
All right. So I have to make it clear, this is going to be my opinion. And I say this because where I feel like a lot of the nicotine replacement therapy literature comes from with NRTs, the patch, is when patients potentially whose gravity of the addiction wasn't as severe as the patients we face now. Like one of the frustrations I was sharing earlier is there really isn't a uniform understanding of a person who smokes like there is in cancer. If I said someone's got stage 4 cancer, you're like, oh, that's bad, right? Versus stage 1. Like we have definitions that create uniformity so we know how to tackle those patients. Stage 4 patients, breast cancer, get different treatments than stage 1 cancer patients. So Kat, you asked me a great question and I have a frustration of that response of we do a horrible job as a medical institution of creating uniformity around these patients. I even told you, I throw out packs per year. It's not used for that. Cigarettes are different and they're dosed with a lot of non-nicotine alkaloids that drive addiction. So I can't even use nicotine to say, I think I can gauge a proximity of your severity. How you smoke a cigarette? Well, if that person tells you to smoke 20 cigarettes, but they're cheap and you do this really fast versus the Marlboro guy who does 5 cigarettes casually, comfortably, it's all different. So what I would say, Kat, and to the listeners, treat everyone as your most refractory case. Don't let them shy away with like, oh, it's only 2 cigarettes, doc. You're going 21. We're going hard. And you know what? What ends up happening is everyone's trajectory changes depending on where they're going. So if I start at 21, what I'm looking for is a 50% reduction on their end. And that can take anywhere from 2 to 3 months before we see that. That's what I'm holding. So if they start at 40 cigarettes a day and they get to 20, now we can start discussing cutting back. If they start at 2 cigarettes a day and they got to 1 in a week, great. Now we can discuss cutting back. I'm looking for a 50% reduction. That's what I tend to do. Where this is coming from, it's my clinical gestalt of how I've managed patients. I can't really rely on the literature because those patients are not the ones I'm seeing in clinic. That's another frustrating thing. This is now like, you know, we're kind of out there alone in this because our patients don't tend to match the researched patients, right? They don't hold the same issues that my patients do of why they smoke, of what they smoke and so forth. So I start high, I go to 14 after 50% reduction in a conversation with the patient if they feel comfortable enough. Many will tell me no. They'll go to 14, they're like, I don't like it. Go back to 21. So I will. What I end up doing, Kat, ultimately, start at 21, at 50% reduction, then I start talking about going to 14. At some point, I do get them to 14. I go to 7 when they're off their cigarette, and they tend to keep it at 7 for anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks after their last cigarette. Because here's the other thing. You all know people smoke differently. They smoke in good times and bad times. But what if I got them to finally stop smoking during a moment where the stars all aligned? And this happened to one of my patients. A week later, their spouse died, and all they wanted to do was go back to smoking. And they will tell me if they didn't have that patch kind of lingering on, they would have relapsed back to 2 packs a day. Took a hit of a cigarette, but they were able to cut back very quickly. So that's the part that we have to recognize. These patients aren't stopping in a vacuum. They're stopping in real life. And we just may be able to have been successful because things were aligning just fine right now. So I tend to prolong both the patch and varenicline for weeks after their last cigarette, and then ultimately wean it off, and then just have them use the nicotine replacement short-acting agents as needed to curb any future cravings. But Kat had a dose. I hit hard. I dropped to 14 after 50% reduction. And then I go to 7 after the last cigarette, and I make it linger for some time.
Do you ever go higher than 21 and have people use more than one patch?
The answer is yes. And it depends on the patient. So I will tell you who I've used it on, and I will quickly just bring it up. I've used it a lot sometimes on patients who have a reason to try to get off the cigarettes faster. 21 milligrams is a fine dose, even if we're your 3 to 4 pack a day person. We'll chip away at it. It's just the timeline may be months to a year or two. But if they really need to be off the cigarettes, carefully monitoring them, you have to carefully monitor them, I will make them drop. I will also emphasize trying to wear the patches as far away from the chest area, because the closer they are, the faster it gets as an intake with closer proximity to the heart, meaning you can mitigate the tachycardia induced from the nicotine content by just placing it a little bit further away. So that's what I will try to prepare them for. I tend to also not keep them on the 2 patches for a while, but for a while, if I do it, it's usually somewhere around 6 to 8 weeks, and I try to see how they're doing. But it doesn't have to be 2 21s. It can be a 1 21 and a 7. I've done that multiple times. I think on a rare occasion, I've done 2 21s. But again, what tends to drive me there is they like the patches. It works. You just need a higher dose. And the patients will tell you that. And we'll start weaning it down.
So while we're talking about nicotine replacement therapy, you know, it's really helpful to hear kind of your approach to how you would keep them on and thinking about relapse prevention early on. But two quick questions. One is for the patch, I've had some patients ask about or tell me that the patch falls off when they sweat, if you have any kind of advice for that. The second thing is about nicotine gum and just like, you know, a lot of my patients say like, well, I just chew it like regular gum. So can you just tell us about how you would counsel patients for that?
Of course, Kenny. Great questions. So for those who are very diaphoretic, I have those patients too. I know I'm guilty of it too. I perspire a lot. So a couple things. It's really like, these are things you don't learn in medical school, essentially. You kind of really just try to understand, well, what are they doing? Like, is this a construction worker wearing like a shirt where their like arms are exposed and it's just barely covering the chest, right? Like those undershirts, if that's all they're wearing and they're really perspiring a lot, understood. What I actually encourage them, and we've done it in clinic, is like, can you just, you know, grab some surgical tape, right? We'll grab it from what your surgeons use for wounds and wrap it around the patch and keep it there. Yeah, it takes an extra bit of time and it kind of showcases a little bit of commitment, but that's what they tend to do. And I'll say this, they like it. At the end of the day, yeah, it's a little bit of extra time, but they like it because it hides the patch. So there's no one judging them about their smoking. So one of the tactics I will use is the wrapping around situation. For people who wear bras, sometimes I'll ask them, you know, can you tuck it in to the bra against your skin? Who gave me that insight have been like my patients who are lifeguards, and they're like, that's where I would wear it. They're like, it really sticks and it's easier. So I've had those kind of strategies. So you just have to be clever. That's it. So the patients who sweat, I hear you. We just have to kind of MacGyver the situation a little bit. For the gum and the lozenges, this is great. It was one of the things that comes in, right? We talked about Kenny, but what did they use in the past? And they're like, oh, doc, I use the gum and I get nauseous on it. I'm never doing it again. You know, I'm like, all right, someone didn't tell you how to use this. And I really dislike the fact that it's called gum or lozenges, because it gives people the impression of like, I know how to do it. you don't have to belittle me. Like, no, it's not you. Grab my medical student, grab my 30-year resident. They won't know how to do it. So you're right. The gum and the lozenges both have to be parked and left there for several minutes to really let the nicotine get into the venous system of the oropharynx, ultimately to curb those cravings that patients will have. If you masticate it or you suck on it like a regular gum or lozenge, respectfully, what's that end up happening is like all that nicotine builds in the saliva, then you either swallow it, which isn't going to do any good because your stomach's going to hate that high bolus of nicotine content, or you're going to spit it out. So yes, you got to park it. Sometimes chew and park, or sometimes take the lozenge to leave it against your gums, which is also my favorite thing when people are like, well, I have dentures, it's not going to work for me. I'm like, you know, spit on it, break it a little bit, and just park it, like chewing tobacco. They're like, oh, all right, I guess I can do that, right? Again, it's sabotage planning. You're just trying to get ahead of the game from that perspective. One thing, let me just make a quick mention here to all the listeners. I hope you guys realize the nicotine replacement therapies are meant to curb the cravings, but they are incredibly poorly constructed to act like the nicotine delivery of a cigarette. The nicotine delivery of a cigarette, high concentration, chemically enhanced, right? The ammonias, the tars, the heavy metals are meant to demethylate and create a free-base nicotine. And it also bypasses the main organ that breaks down all the nicotine through the CYP2A6 enzyme, right? Your liver. Because when you smoke, it goes into the lungs, heart, squeeze, pump, brain. Our gum and lozenges, our patches, they're all in the venous return system. So I see this because, like, you got to prepare patients. Like, this is not going to hit you as hard as or as fast as a cigarette to take away these cravings. It has to build up. You know, they're built to kind of be these slow releasers, even if it is gum and lozenges that are meant to be more of a bolus, still a slow bolus. So you got to prepare patients that as quickly as a cigarette makes them feel good, nothing's going to replicate in that kind of pharmacotherapy trajectory of any of our NRTs to start mitigating the cravings. So I just try to prepare them for that. If your craving's really that bad, still use the lozenge and gum, just give it a few minutes. With that said, the closest would probably be the nasal spray. I like it, it's just expensive. Patients like it because it's discreet. So if patients want to use a nicotine nasal spray, one thing to prepare them for, Kenny, we talk about the gum and lozenge, so how to use a nasal spray. You got to let them know that the first couple times you'll use a nasal spray, they will curse your name. They will hate you. Because that nicotine going in here is going to burn like the dickens. So you got to prepare them. It gets easier the more they get used to it. And once they get used to it, they end up loving it. And who I've actually really turned it on, what patients tend to really enjoy it tend to be people who are active in society. My older patient who predominantly stays at home, yeah, they're fine. They'll use what they have. My, you know, 44-year-old patient who's out and about working with people, he doesn't like popping the gum or the lozenge. It's there. It's evident. Doesn't like wearing the patch. It may be obvious. The spray is so discreet. They love that. So sometimes I will decide on a product based on someone's social engagements and how discreet they want to be. I'm telling you, the nasal spray, a lot of people love it. It's just the cost is what tends to prohibit its use.
I wonder if you could talk about the cost for some of the other formulations, or what have you had luck with getting covered by insurance or not?
Okay. First things first, I'll make this one part I want to say. Cost has been one of the biggest barriers for a lot of the patients. Yes, we can talk about the medicine of this, but the politics of the insurance coverage, Kat, Natalie, you guys are spot on. It is a barrier. In our clinic, we fought tooth and nail to get cigarette restitution funds to cover the medications for all of our patients. It's great, but it's not replicated anywhere else in our healthcare system. So it's frustrating, like, yay us, but my gosh, it's like a drop in the bucket versus what we could be doing more. So a couple of things that I want to tell your listeners when you decide on these products. For nicotine replacement therapies, consider the quitlines to be kind of an adjunct with you because they can usually get the NRTs. The challenge with quitlines is they're not all the same from state to state and how quickly they are or how long they'll give these. Because in my opinion, every medication for tobacco dependence should be a lifetime supply. You may not need it for a lifetime, don't get me wrong, but you know, just like a hypertensive medication, you realize, hey, even if I have to stop it because life is good, they control their numbers with their lifestyle changes, I may have to reintroduce it if they flare up again. So that's the one part. So just, you know, you can get it for free, but you got to understand the logistics of like how long they can keep them for and so forth. Bupropion, I will tell you, I will do everything possible when I order it to not associate it with smoking. Because depending on the pharmacy, they'll link it to the name brand drug, which is very expensive. bupropion's been around since the mid-1980s. So if that happens with the pharmacy and the patient will be like, "Doctor, what do you do? I'm not going to pay $200 for this." I'm like, "Oh, okay." I reorder it, and I tend to put like an ICD-10 code of mood change. I call the patient and tell them that. Because bupropion then will be given generic, and it's perfectly fine. So I will circumvent that. I'm hoping that's okay with your listeners and so forth. But it's frustrating. Like, we got to find ways to be cost-effective for patients. And now varenicline, which went generic, fantastic, mazel tov. Now we can hunt down the pharmacist who carried the generic version. That's the hardest part. So it is generic, much more cost-effective for patients compared to when it was a name brand. You just have to see what pharmacies are carrying it. That's the hardest part. So the cost factor, I'm with you. It's there. It's real. Sometimes I will tell you we can circumvent that by thinking outside the box of how to dose these medications. Like, yeah, if your patients really want a fixed income, maybe they just take varenicline on bad days and they'll use, you know, the short acting agents on good days. So like I said, these are the right ingredients. They will do what we need them to. We just have to prepare patients for the timing, and we have to take into account the patient's cost effectiveness. And if anything we do to assist, right, because NRTs, you can get them for free. If you program, you can get it for a $5 copay with right diagnosis attached to it. And varenicline as a generic, you know, can be anywhere from $10 to $20 as a copay, which again, it's cost effective. So it's a perspective of what that means to people. But the days of paying for $200 for these medications should really be behind us. We just have to work the system as much as we can for the patients. At the end of the day, we're doing it for the patients. We have to be there for them. Great question, by the way. And it's one that it's important. It's important to understand, you know, like what's going on with these patients who, keep in mind, they're willing, you know, the product that they're trying to get off of gives them something every day, right? It is to them some kind of mental health benefit. I'm not ignorant of that, right? If it felt like getting hit in the head by a hammer, they would have stopped long ago. It's providing them a benefit. Right now, we're taking that away without at all replacing it, right? None of these products are replacing the cigarette. We have to be mindful of that. And for patients, you know, the second they find some reason to sabotage your plan, it's all gone.
You know, speaking of kind of cost issues and insurance coverage and just accessibility to these meds, I know that varenicline had a recall not too long ago, and that kind of had like a chilling effect on varenicline prescribing in my practice. And also a lot of my patients are afraid to take it now. Just wanted to get your thoughts on how that's affected your patients in your practice.
So varenicline really is, in the world of tobacco dependence, the big game-changing medication, right? It's the only one that can competitively block the acetylcholine receptors intended for nicotine to go to and drive an addiction. I mean, it's frightened the tobacco company since it came out. And those black box warnings, you can make an argument, those weren't just. I mean, SSRIs cause suicidal ideations at higher rates than varenicline ever did. As does Keppra, neither of them have black box warnings. What I'm trying to build up here is potentially, you know, stuff that I'm trying to read in between the lines when I see stuff like this. Like, it's varenicline already, because of those warnings, had a bad perspective by many physicians and many community members. I have many patients come in and they're like, "You want to give me the med that causes me to kill myself?" I mean, it's gotten in there, right? The popularity contest of varenicline has been soiled by the ambushes of external forces. It's frustrating. So you're trying to undo this. And then you're right, the recall for the coding potentially to cause cancer, which if you look at it from the grand scheme of things, a daily use of the medication over decades would raise the risk for cancer, yes. But that's not how we use varenicline, and we're trying to stop something that clearly causes cancer almost in the immediate sense. It was frustrating to see that, because regardless of the debates I can have with epidemiologists, oncologists, and public health officials, I don't think people realize it again sours a medication that really can be life-saving. It's frustrating. Like, the amount of attacks this medication gets for really doing what we want a medication to do, there are external forces at play that are enjoying watching varenicline never achieve its full potential because of just this such bad publicity that we kind of self-inflict.
So just to sum up kind of what we talked about so far is if we're first seeing a patient like Mr. T, you don't talk about the quit like a quit date immediately, and we can start long acting or maybe two long acting things, varenicline, bupropion if there's a reason to not try varenicline, and nicotine replacement patch using the kind of usually at 21 milligrams, and then something short acting, gum or lozenges, making sure they know that parking it is when it actually gets to their bloodstream and knowing that it's going to go into their blood and not hit them in the same way that a cigarette will, and knowing that any of those nicotine replacement things, they can take it off at night or not use it at night if it's causing nightmares, but they don't need to preemptively do that necessarily, or when they're smoking for that matter. And then you don't, and you say, let's come back and see how you're feeling in a month, because a lot of people will cut down on how much they're smoking. And this is part of trying to, and you'll ask them to keep a journal and kind of be mindful of when they're still smoking and what's prompting them to, so that you can have a more effective conversation when they come back to clinic.
No, Natalie, you're spot on. I mean, the whole goal of this is for them to view how to become a non-smoker. And it, to me, it's a weaning down strategy, cigarette after cigarette, having them understand why they smoke, using the medications to help with those cravings, to calm them down. Choose the long-acting one that makes the most sense for them. Double up if we need to. Triple up if that's patches, bupropion, and varenicline on some patients. But the short-acting agents there for really difficult times. But you got to make it clear that patient mindfulness, to me, is the tactic, that new habit they have to begin to learn to really be mindful of how to say no to a cigarette, or at least report back what are the hardest cigarettes. Because I will tell you, the funnest time I have with the patients are the first couple visits. The hardest visits are the ones where they're down to about 2 to 3 cigarettes. Because you got to keep in mind, those are the hardest cigarettes they have to break. And they tend to be linked with a lot more mental health issues that have just really gone undiagnosed. And it's, to them, it's been their safety blanket. And now I'm trying to take that away with them. I got to learn, right? This is where more counseling then begins to dive in and so forth. Look, this is the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my practice. I mean this. I love caring for people who smoke. It means the world to me. And for them to say I'm a non-smoker means the world. And if you guys all want one more tactic out there, one more tactic to kind of gain a sense of homophily, Mr. T was my patient. What I tend to do with all of them is I discreetly tend to look at their birthdays before they come in. So say Mr. T's birthday is, I don't know, June 30th. I'd sit there, and depending where June 30th is in the proximity of when we're having this clinic, if it's about 6 months away, I tell them you'll be close to being a non-smoker. If it's like tomorrow, then I'd be like, by the next June 30th, you're going to be a non-smoker. And what ends up happening is they hear their birthday just mentioned. They're like, wait, that's my birthday. So right off the bat, you reintroduce this tactic known as homophily, and this tactic of them seeing you as a person. You know something really important about them, and you brought it up in a manner that regained their attention at a moment you may have been losing it, because everyone's attention is lost after 60 minutes. You rebring it back. You guys got to know your patient. At the end of the day, know why they smoke, and then help them take that notion and redistribute that power back to them. And yes, medications, by all means, use. Just use in a manner that still emphasizes they're in control, and these meds are meant to empower them through this journey.
Okay, so I know that health equity is a big part of the work that you do. Is there anything related to health disparities, health equity for tobacco use cessation that we should have talked about but we haven't talked about?
So everyone out there should dive into tobacco dependence and the science of it, because maybe your science is cancer prevention, tobacco. Maybe it's mental health, tobacco. Maybe it's health disparities, tobacco, right? This is huge because tobacco really plagues a lot of the have-nots versus the haves. More people socioeconomic disadvantage smoke more than those of more affluency. More minority races tend to smoke and suffer the smoking-related complications than non-minority races, right? This goes down the health disparity line. And one conversation I want to have has to do with race, that I recognize as a social construct. There is some recognition of a certain genetic issue that came up in about the 1970s, 1980s that the tobacco company became hip with. Menthol, I think when we hear this out loud, we all begin to realize, yes, menthol cigarettes tend to target Black African-American populations more than their other counterparts. So you may ask yourself, well, why is that? We all like menthol. One of the thoughts of menthol early on was that it made smoking easier to enjoy, right? Your first cigarette at 14, you're not coughing up a lung. It's easier to take in, right? Menthol's a cough suppressant. But menthol also seems to make an impact on acetylcholine receptors. This is the devil of it, right? It seems to, especially if you have a gene called the THR292, genetic predisposition to creating deformed acetylcholine receptors, it really doesn't do anything unless you try to introduce nicotine. And guess what? Nicotine can't stimulate that acetylcholine receptor. Well, if it can't stimulate it, Natalie, it won't be able to drive an addiction. So who did the tobacco scientists really realize clustered with that gene? A lot of Black African Americans. So they tended to put mentholated cigarettes to truly target those populations in case they're running around with one of those genes preventing a really good nicotine addiction. So that menthol chemically behaves to drive nicotine addiction by keeping those acetylcholine receptors nice and open, allowing the nicotine to go through, throw off some dopamine down the path. So one of the frustrations that we have trying to fight menthol overall is to try to regulate it, right? Tobacco companies keep winning, saying it's a flavoring, you can't regulate flavorings. We can if we can prove it's got a chemical impact towards nicotine addiction. So I really think if we remove menthol, we're going to find a lot of patients in the future find it a lot easier to become non-smokers. But yeah, health disparities. If you guys are out there and you're like, I like health disparities, join us in the tobacco dependence world. That's all we do. We fight for the most vulnerable populations every day.
Well, thank you so much for, you know, giving us the big perspective and also kind of the smaller perspective of how you treat patients in your office. Do you have any main take-home points for our listeners?
So my main take-home point, I'm going to oversimplify this, but for the purpose of this context, make sure you reframe the patient's tobacco dependence. It's not about quitting. It's about becoming a non-smoker, right? That helps them reassess their journey in this. Know your patient. Understand why they smoke. That's key. Because the more you understand, the more then they will understand, and you begin to empower them. And then third, use the pharmacotherapy that makes the most sense for those patients. And strategize and individualize it when to use them, right? I always say we have the right ingredients. We just got to figure out the right recipe for you. Get to know your patients will help transcend all of those three. So from my standpoint, every patient who comes in who smokes warrants the same sophisticated science and clinical attention that any other non-communicable disease out there. We give it to them. They deserve it.
And last thing, is there anything you'd like to plug tonight?
No plug-in, just maybe this podcast. You guys are great. The plug is to always remember what gives physicians our identity are our patients. And everyone who smokes deserves a chance to become a non-smoker. That's it. No other plug.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes now at thecurbsiders.com/addiction. And I want to say this episode, it's a wrap on our first season. So we want to thank everybody for listening in. I know it takes a huge team to really make this into reality. So I really want to give some special shout outs to Dr. Sean Cohen, who couldn't be here tonight, Dr. Zena Huxley-Riker, Dr. Hannah Donishva, and Dr. Ira Krzyzanowskaya, Castosh Production, Carly Roy, Dr. Jeanette Tetro, and just all of the phenomenal guests who have spent their time and their energy working with us this season.
So as always, we are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. A special thanks to ACAM, Dr. Matt Watto, and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project.
A reminder that this and most episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.bcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. Until next season, I've been Dr. Natalie Stahl.
I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan.
I'm Dr. Kat Mullins.
And I'm Dr. Kenny Morford. Thank you so much for joining us today. And most importantly, thank you for caring for patients with substance use disorders. So we did it, guys. That's it. That's a wrap on season one.
Hooray!
Oh, great.